The Black Doctor, T.T. Flynn. Chapter 1. S-13. It was the last evening on the Laurentic, the last dinner before quarantine, and the slow progress up the bay past the Statue of Liberty and into the river, where snorting tugs would skillfully guide the big liner into her berth. 6 days out from Southampton, the Laurentic had found 5 days of bad weather, of plunging seas and gale-swept decks. 4 days in which fully half the passengers had remained below, shunning decks, games, amusements, and food. But all that had passed magically. The skies had cleared, the sweeping seas had smoothed in the sunny calm that followed, and now the big dining saloon was crowded. Val Easton ate with only half an ear on the table conversation. His mind was on other things. The mission that had taken him to London and Rome by way of Paris and then back to London again. The weeks of piecing together tiny bits of information to make the pattern which took shape in his final report. It had been good work, too. The cable from his chief calling him back to Washington had said so. A fragment of the conversation jerked his attention back to the table, without sign of it showing on his lean features. The full-bosomed woman at the head of the table, a Mrs. Beamish, had said aggressively, "The whole thing was bosh. In wartime, perhaps, but not now. Spies are as old-fashioned as the dodo bird." And Mrs. Beamish glared around the table as if daring anyone to take issue with her over the matter. They were, Val realized, talking about the picture that had been shown the evening before, one of the latest thrillers built around the adventures of a famous woman spy during the war. Most of them had seen it. The discussion at once became heated. The most outspoken was the blonde young Mr. Miller at Mrs. Beamish's left, who looked like a poet just out of college and who stood by his convictions heatedly. "Of course there are spies," he protested. "They're always working. You read about them all the time." "And see silly pictures about them," Mrs. Beamish declared sarcastically. "That picture was based on historical facts," he said with the positive assurance of youth. "Whether you liked it or not, it happened. Why, any of us here at the table might be a spy. I might be one working for a foreign government." And visibly set up by the thought, he looked gallantly across the table at the pretty girl on Val's right. Val smiled inwardly. It seemed funny, this talk about spies, almost like a fiction story. Something sinister and diabolical about it. He wondered if he looked the part. Wondered, too, what would happen if this table full of peaceful travelers were apprised of his identity, and could look for a moment into the roiling currents of international intrigue. But Mrs. Beamish leaned forward with a glitter in her eye. "Young man," she asked sharply, "did you ever see a spy?"
Well, no.
"Ah," said Mrs. Beamish, with a cutting smile, and leaned back in her chair as if that settled everything. And young Miller's weak retort of,
"How would I know one if I saw him? They don't go labeled,"
made no impression in her self-satisfied armor. There was a chuckle from the slender, middle-aged Englishman who had sat at the end of the table every meal, beaming through rimless eyeglasses and talking books and authors to whomever would listen. Carmody was his name, a book salesman on a business trip to the States. Now he smiled and bobbed his head as he leaned forward and spoke.
"I fancy Mrs. Beamish is more than a little bit right. This is not wartime, nor is there the wide interest in such things that we had in the days of the old worldwide Imperial German spy service. My firm, by the way, has published 2 books on such things, and I can, modestly claim to know something about it. Spies are practically as dead as the dodo. We have about as much chance of finding one here at the table as we have of missing our dinner in New York tomorrow evening."
And Carmody beamed at them all. The young man retorted sulkily,
"Just the same, I'm still betting on spies. You might be one yourself."
"Ha ha, so I might," Carmody chortled. "And if you'll drop around to the nearest bookstore as soon as you land, at least I'll guarantee you a corking good book on the subject. Make your hair stand up on end if you believe everything that's in it."
"I don't have to read a book to have my mind made up," young Miller said darkly.
and applied himself to his dessert with irritated jabs of his spoon. Val said to Carmody good-naturedly as he left the table,
"I may get that book myself. I've always been curious about such things."
"Do," Carmody beamed. "At least it's jolly good reading. Almost made me wish I had been one myself back in the days when they were taken seriously."
A trim, blue-uniformed young man from the Marconi room came in, paging.
"Mr. Easton, Mr. Easton."
Val lifted a finger. The blue uniform met him, and an envelope was placed in his hands.
"Radiogram, sir."
Val tore it open and deciphered the coded message with the ease of long practice. "V. Easton, on board SS Laurentic. Contact S-13, Beamish. Assist if needed. Signed, Greg." Sheer amazement almost made Val wheel around and glance back at the table. The signature Greg was the code word for the chief, housed at the right elbow of the State Department in Washington. Its sense was plain. Its information, stunning. And for the thousandth time, Val was swept with admiration for the perfection of the intricate and far-flung web of which he was only one strand. S-13. Beamish. Only one meaning to that. That full-bosomed, majestic woman who had sat at the head of the table day after day on this crossing was a part of the same web. That woman who looked like the stodgy, opinionated wife of some equally stodgy businessman. That severe matron whose tall, slender daughter had appeared once briefly on deck with her was, must be, a clever intelligence operative. Val smiled wryly at the thought of how he himself had swallowed her aggressive declaration that no longer did such people exist. Why had she done it? And Val paid her the compliment of believing that there had been a purpose behind it. He tucked the radiogram in his inside coat pocket and strolled out on deck. Half an hour later, Val found Mrs. Beamish standing by the rail, peering pensively down at the endless ribbon of foam-flecked water that rushed astern. A blue coat was wrapped around her ample figure, a chiffon veil held her hair in place against the rush of the night breeze. Even now, his critical scrutiny found it hard to believe she was the one Greg referred to. He leaned against the rail beside her, said casually,
S-13.
What? Mrs. Beamish demanded in a startled voice. Val repeated it. She frowned at him.
Young man, she asked tartly, is this a new way of flirting with an old woman like me?
Greg suggested it, Val said idly.
Hmm,
said Mrs. Beamish shortly. She drew her coat closely around her shoulders, adjusting her veil slowly, turned and eyed him deliberately. A smile slowly broke over her angular face.
So you're the one, she said. My, my. And to think we've been eating at the same table. Greg radioed that one of his men would see us this evening. Come down and meet Nancy. She's been feeling bad the whole trip.
Your daughter?
Mrs. Beamish sniffed.
Bosh! It makes good atmosphere. Whoever would suspect an old fogey like me? I wish Nancy Fraser was my daughter. She's a girl in a million.
Nancy Fraser? I've heard of her.
Val had indeed. Nancy Fraser, tales of whose daring ingenuity were already becoming classics of the intelligence service. An adept at disguise, a quick thinker, a beautiful girl, fearless, resourceful, and blessed with uncanny luck, was this Nancy Fraser. Mrs. Beamish, preceding him into the cabin on B-deck, said,
This is our man, Nance. Mr. Easton, Miss Fraser.
The girl who slid effortlessly to her feet from the bed almost took Val's breath away. She was softly feminine at first glance, a beauty with fine, clean-cut features, slightly suntanned. Her chin was firm and her mouth fairly wide, with a humorous quirk at the corners. She was a platinum blonde, and her silky hair, cut short, was waved close to her head in a style almost mannish. He was to learn later that there was a reason for that. But at the moment he was conscious only of the calm, boring gaze of a pair of the bluest and deepest eyes he had ever seen. They took him apart in one swift look, examined the pieces, and approved, for she smiled and gave him a firm hand.
"I'm glad to see you, Mr. Easton. Sit down. This has been a rocky passage for me. I'm still a little wobbly."
"I was surprised to get Greg's radiogram," Val told her as he seated himself. "I suppose something is up?"
Nancy Fraser's smile faded as she sank on the edge of the bed. She nodded.
"Something is up. I coded Greg a resume of it, and he radioed back that he would have one of his men who was on the ship get in touch with me. I've been waiting for you."
"I would have guessed every other man on the ship," said Mrs. Beamish with a critical look at Val. "You're such a nice, harmless-looking young man. I thought you might be a college professor or a bond salesman."
The front of Nancy Fraser's silk negligee trembled as she laughed softly at Val's wry smile.
"Don't mind Nora, Mr. Easton. She's apt to break out with some startling remarks."
"Hmm," said Mrs. Beamish. "I say what I think when it suits me."
Nancy Fraser became serious once more.
"Here's what we're up against, Mr. Easton. I'm working on a delicate matter. As near as I understand it, the stage is all set for some world-shaking moves that haven't even been hinted at in the newspapers. Anything may come out of it. The Shanghai business is only a move in a bigger game. Japan, Russia, England, France, and Italy are all holding different hands in the Far East. Our government is vitally concerned. Treaties, agreements, protestations by statesmen are all for public consumption. Behind that, the real moves are being made. The different foreign offices are the only ones who really know."
"And some of them don't know as much as they'd like to," Val commented.
"Exactly. None of them do. Each one is afraid of what the others may be doing. I doubt if the intelligence services have been half as busy since the war as they are now. Wires, cables, and radio services are being tapped. Confidential codes being broken down and deciphered. Mails are being watched, intelligence operators planted where they can get at the contents of diplomatic pouches, and scores of men in high positions are being watched day and night for some clue as to what their governments are driving at. It's a mess. World peace, or another war that will make the last look like a kindergarten exercise, are in the balance."
Val knew all that, but he liked the crisp way this Nancy Fraser went to the heart of the matter. He was seeing another side of the beautiful girl who had cordially greeted him. A woman, this, who was steely hard beneath her femininity, who thought straight and to the point.
"Where do you come in?" he questioned bluntly.
"At the moment, I'm following a man who stands high in the British diplomatic service, a man who is coming to the States on a secret mission. He is traveling incognito as a Mr. Galbraith. I'm confident he is carrying secret papers or instructions that can't be entrusted to the mails or cables."
"Who is he?"
"Sir Edward Lynn, a tall, thin man with a close-clipped black mustache."
"Haven't noticed him."
"Probably not. He has kept to his cabin most of the trip."
"That seems simple enough," Val said, offering his cigarettes to the two women and holding a light for them.
Nancy Fraser leaned back on one arm and nodded.
"It is simple enough. Only, we're being followed, too."
Those last, sharp, vibrant words brought a sudden tang of danger into the atmosphere of the cabin. Val snapped alert, eyed her keenly.
"Who is following you?"
Nancy Fraser shook her head.
"That's the trouble," she confessed. "Neither Nora nor I have been able to find out. But someone knows who we are, or suspects us. Our cabin was entered one of the few times we both were out of it. Entered, searched cleverly, and left exactly as it had been."
"How did you discover it?"
Nora Beamish smiled proudly.
"That girl is a wonder, Mr. Easton. She never leaves her room without fixing it so she knows at once whether it has been disturbed."
"A few little ends of silk thread that are never noticed when they are displaced," Nancy Fraser explained. "To make certain this time, I questioned the stewardess closely. She had not been in here."
She didn't have to say anything more. Too well Val understood why she was disturbed. It was bad enough to match wits with dangers one was aware of, but there was nothing more unnerving than to find that one's disguise had been penetrated, that unknown danger lurked close, and to be unable to discover it and take precautions. Until Nancy Fraser found out who had searched her cabin, she must suspect everyone on the boat, must look for anything to happen at any hour of the day or night.
"Suspect anyone?" he prompted.
"No, we're up in the air."
The room had a narrow window opening on the promenade deck, a window halfway up with the drawn curtains inside swaying slightly in the wind. And just as Nancy Fraser answered him, a harder gust than usual blew the right curtain aside. Val's eye caught a fleeting glimpse of a shoulder shifting hastily back to one side. Someone was out there listening. Chapter 2. Death on B-Deck. Val made a cat-like lunge to his feet, reached the window in a silent stride, and grabbed through it. As he expected, the shoulder was just outside. His fingers dug hard into the rough woolen cloth, and he jerked hard to bring the lurking figure over to where he could see the face. The other made no sound, but the hard edge of a taut palm struck the bone just above his wrist, a terrific blow. It was jiu-jitsu, skillfully, savagely, and instantly applied. His hand went numb and useless, and the blinding pain shot above his elbow. With a twist, the shoulder tore away and was gone. Val jerked his arm in, biting his lower lip against the gasp of agony that rushed to his teeth. Nancy Fraser had come to her feet alertly and was staring wide-eyed as Val whirled toward the door. "Someone listening out there," he threw at her, and jerked the door open with his good hand and rushed out on deck. The promenade was brightly lighted. At least a score of people were visible from the back of the long sweep of deck, but most of them were leaning over the rail, the others strolling astern. No one at the moment had his eyes fixed on the spot, and the deck was empty. A deck bay was a few yards away. His man must have gone there, but when Val reached it, he found the bay empty and none of the chairs occupied. The companion door at the back was closed. He opened it, looked into the passage beyond, and swore under his breath. His man had moved fast and surely, had gotten away. Val was forced to admit that fact after a few moments' search. He met a steward in the passage, asked the man sharply,
"Did you see a man come through here a few moments ago?"
His tense manner drew a curious look from the white-jacketed little Cockney.
"Ain't seen a soul, sir."
"Sure?"
"I don't make mistakes, sir. A man can't afford to when he's holding down a nick on a toppler like the Laurentic, sir. Is there something wrong?"
"Nothing," said Val, turning back. "Thank you."
Nancy Fraser had put on pumps and a coat that covered her negligee. She was standing near her door when Val returned. She met him with a questioning look.
"He got away," Val admitted unwillingly. "I was a fool to grab at him through the window like that, but I wanted a quick look at his face. He gave my wrist a crack that paralyzed it and was gone."
"You didn't see him at all?"
"No."
"Let's take a turn around the deck," she said abruptly. "We've made a mess of things. Whoever it is knows you're with us now. I wish we had thought of that."
"I shouldn't have gone to your cabin," Val admitted. "Wouldn't have if I'd known what was up. But I didn't suspect it was this bad."
"Nora knew. She should have stopped you. And I should have closed that window. But we all make mistakes. I wonder how much he overheard."
"We weren't talking loud."
"Loud enough, I'm afraid," she said gloomily. "Darn it, the cat's out of the bag now. I'm much worse off than I was when I radioed Greg. It's terrible. We've got to find out who it was."
"Line up a few hundred first-class passengers and look them in the eye, I suppose," Val suggested.
"Your ideas are about as good as mine."
"This is the last night. On shore, we may be able to do something about it."
"And maybe not. Don't you see we're both practically useless now until we get at the truth of this?"
They made the circuit of the deck twice, and finally Val suggested,
"You might as well turn in. I'll stay up later and keep my eyes open. I'll let you know if I see anything."
Her hand clasp was cool and firm, her good night brief, but her smile warm. Val walked away, thinking about her. At midnight, the deck lights were dimmed. The strollers began to thin out. Val stayed out, for he was not sleepy. For hours, he had been thinking about Nancy Fraser and this new bit of business. Who was so interested in her?
What did it mean? In other professions, one might have shrugged the whole matter aside until something else happened, but not in his and Nancy Fraser's. If they didn't think at least two jumps ahead of the other party, the results might be disastrous. A steward passed with a tray holding a pot of coffee. "Bring me a pot of coffee," Val told him, and the steward touched his cap.
"Yes, sir, soon as I get back, sir."
Val leaned on the rail and stared out at the vast expanse of sea heaving slowly under the moonlight. Light steps came to his side. It was Nancy Fraser.
"I couldn't sleep," she said under her breath. "I wondered if I would find you out here."
"I'm having coffee in a few minutes. Care for some?"
"Sounds good. It might help my memory. I've been lying in bed trying to think of any suspicious move I've seen since I came aboard. I'm stymied."
"Ditto," Val admitted. They waited there at the rail, talking low. Nancy said finally,
"I thought you had ordered coffee."
Val looked at his wristwatch and saw that 25 minutes had passed as they lingered at the rail. "That steward must have forgotten it," he said irritably. "Let's look him up." They walked slowly back along the deck, and suddenly, without warning, a woman screamed with shrill, hysterical fear. Nancy Fraser stopped short, her hand gripping Val's arm convulsively.
"What's wrong?"
she gasped. The scream had come from ahead of them. Near the rear of the dimly lighted promenade, Val saw two feminine figures backing toward the rail. "I'll see," he jerked out under his breath, and leaving Nancy Fraser to follow, he ran toward the spot. He met the two women hurrying toward him. Two middle-aged spinsters. He had noticed them before during the trip, and now they were badly frightened. One was near hysteria as she turned and pointed back to the spot where Val had first seen them.
"There's something wrong there," she cried shrilly. I stumbled over an arm sticking out of the doorway. I think someone is dead.
"Wait here," Val ordered sharply. "If anyone's dead, you can't be hurt." He found the door a moment later, and as he came up to it, saw an arm thrust out at the bottom. A white-clad arm, sticking straight and motionless into the dim light of the deck. An arm that lay on the floor, its rigid fingers grasping talon-like at the empty air. Val swore softly under his breath. It was a ghastly sight. For that arm seemed to be reaching, groping with desperate futility for something that had withdrawn beyond reach. He stooped and lifted the hand. The flesh was clammy and cooling already. It was flaccid, limp, with that slackness which comes only from one thing. Whatever the arm had been reaching for, it had found only death. The door was ajar. The cabin inside was dark, silent. Doors were opening along the deck. Passengers were looking out. Nancy Fraser joined him.
"What is it?"
she asked breathlessly. Val reached inside for the light switch. "You'd better not look," he advised. "This won't be nice."
"I've probably seen worse sights,"
she reported coolly, and looked in past his shoulder as the light flashed on inside. Whatever sights Nancy had witnessed before, they had not hardened her enough to stop the gasp of horror which burst from her. Even Val himself could not take it coolly. The steward whom he had accosted half an hour before was lying there on the floor before them. Lying, twisted on his side, knees pulled half up, one hand clutching the front of his white jacket and the other reaching out through the door in that frantic, gruesome gesture. And on the doorsill his face was turned up to them, drawn and crimsoned with congested blood, mouth open, tongue protruding, and bulging eyes set in a horrible, sightless stare.
"He's dead,"
Nancy said huskily. Val nodded. "Yes, dead all right. This is the man I ordered coffee from. No wonder he didn't bring it." Looking beyond the body, he saw on the floor the tray the steward had been carrying. It had been dropped. Cup and saucer were shattered into bits. The pot lay on its side, the dark brown contents making a long stain on the rug, surrounded by a snowy sprinkling of sugar. "He died almost as soon as he entered," Val muttered. "Didn't even have a chance to put his tray down. Dropped it cold." His eyes ran over the body as he said that. There was no sign of blood, and no marks of a struggle either.
except for the spot in front where the starched white cloth was caught in convulsive fingers. The coat was neat and trim. Even the man's carefully combed black hair was in place. It had been smoothed down with hairdressing and was as sleek as it had been when he had walked along the deck. Nancy noticed all that, too, for she said,
"It must have been heart failure."
"Looks that way," Val agreed. A deck officer came running up in the van of half a dozen passengers closing in on the spot.
"What is it?"
he panted.
"One of your stewards must have had a heart attack," Val said, standing aside so that the officer could get a good look.
The bronze-cheeked, broad-shouldered young man pushed the door open all the way and stepped inside.
"Here's what's this?"
he uttered in a startled voice.
"Wake up, sir!"
And over his shoulder.
"The man must be a sound sleeper."
Stepping in, too, Val saw what he had missed with the door partly closed and his attention centered around the doorway. The bed was occupied by a man clad in blue silk pajamas.
"That man's not sleeping," Val said sharply.
The young deck officer swore softly.
He's dead, too,"
he said shakily. In fact, it was hard to see how the officer had been mistaken in the first place. No man would be sleeping that way. For the occupant of the bed lay in a twisted, contorted position also. One hand clutched his throat. The other had hooked around a pillow, drawing it tightly against his side, as if he had grabbed wildly at the nearest thing. The covers had been kicked down. One more roll would have taken the body off on the floor. And the mouth was open, the tongue protruding, the features congested with blood exactly as the steward's were. Both men had died the same way. All that Val got in a glance, and in the same moment he recognized the man on the bed with dumbfounded surprise. It was Carmody, the cheerful British book salesman. Carmody's body bore no marks of violence either. No wounds, no blood. The death that had come to him as he lay in bed was the more ghastly and mysterious because of it.
"I'll get the captain and the ship's doctor here," said the deck officer hoarsely. "Watch the cabin, will you, please? Keep these people out."
As he stepped out, the young man closed the door as far as he could and said appealingly to the passengers gathered outside,
"Please return to your cabins."
But by the excited remarks that drifted in, none of them paid any attention to the request. Val bent over the bed and touched the arm clutching the pillow. It was rigid. Frowning, he tested one of the legs. Rigor mortis had already set in. The flesh was cold. It was not logical. He turned to the steward. That body was still flaccid and the flesh was warm in comparison to the body on the bed. Val fumbled for a cigarette, and then thought better of it and stood staring from one to the other. Both men had died in the same manner. One body was cold and set with rigor mortis, and the other was warm and limp. It did not make sense. There were cases, Val knew, where rigor mortis set in quickly. But this death that had come in the same manner to both men would not react so differently. There was only one conclusion to draw. The steward had been dead for half an hour. Carmody had been dead for hours. And yet both had died in the same manner. Both had died horribly, yet without marks of violence. The door opened and Nancy slipped in and closed it behind her.
"They're gabbling out there like a flock of excited chickens and roosters," she whispered. "What's the explanation of all this?"
Val shrugged helplessly.
"I'm wondering."
He told her what he had discovered.
"Do you know this man?"
he asked, jerking a thumb toward Carmody.
"No."
Carmody's coat and trousers were neatly hung up. His shoes were together on the floor, his shirt and tie and underwear on a chair as he had taken them off and arranged them. Under the bed was a Gladstone bag, apparently undisturbed. Everything else in the cabin was in order. The window was closed. A fragment of memory sent Val to the door. In the outside of the lock was a key with a small wooden handle to it, the steward's master key, which he had apparently used to open the locked door. Val shook his head in answer to the questions that were thrown at him by the people outside, and closed the door again.
"It's got me stumped," he confessed to Nancy. "There's a gruesome mystery here."
And when, a few moments later, the captain and the ship's surgeon entered, Val explained how he and Nancy happened to be in there and pointed out what he had found. Captain McCragg was a burly, weather-beaten man who still carried the dogged, gruff manner of old sailing days. Dr. Sims, the ship's doctor, was short and slender, with a neat Van Dyke and shell-rimmed glasses. He made a swift examination of the bodies, and then pulled the steward's outstretched arm in enough to let the door close tightly. Captain McCragg had been watching impatiently. Now he demanded,
"What do you think of it, Doctor?"
The doctor polished his glasses with the middle of a handkerchief.
"Mr. Easton is right," he said slowly. "These men did not die at the same time. That one on the bed has been dead for hours, and this steward died very recently."
"What killed them?"
The doctor fitted his glasses precisely on his nose, glanced at the bodies, and then at the captain.
"I would suggest an autopsy, Captain. Neither of them has been wounded in any manner, as far as I can see. They have all the appearance of dying from suffocation, yet there are no marks about their throats to indicate any violence which would cause that."
"In other words," the captain snorted, "you don't know anything about it."
The doctor was unruffled.
"Precisely," he answered calmly. "I have never seen anything quite like it. The window is closed, the door was apparently locked, or the steward would not have used his key from the outside."
"That means," Val pointed out quickly, "that the steward was delivering an order to a man who had been dead in his locked cabin for hours."
The captain glared at him.
"Then who ordered it?"
he snapped.
"Perhaps the autopsy will show that," Val smiled.
The captain stepped to the door, opened it, beckoned the deck officer, and growled,
"Check up on the order that was brought here by this steward. Find what time it is given and who ordered it."
And when he closed the door again, the captain said,
"I wonder who this chap is."
Val mentioned what he knew of Carmody, which was little enough.
"We'll search his effects and see if there's anything more," the captain decided. "He ought to have his passport and some papers. His people will have to be notified by radio and asked what to do with the body. Blast it, I hate a business like this. It's bad for a ship's reputation."
Val suggested, "Right now, it's more to the point to find out what killed them."
"You talk like a detective."
"I'm not," said Val calmly, and let the matter rest there. But he and Nancy Fraser stayed as the captain and the doctor hurriedly searched the cabin. They found a billfold and some small change, a pocket knife, a fountain pen flashlight clipped inside the coat, passport book and several letters, a key that opened the locked Gladstone. The captain's thick fingers fumbled through the clothes inside. With a grunt, he drew out an English Army model automatic pistol and two extra clips filled with cartridges.
He said, tossing them onto the bed. "What does he want to carry these for? Army model, too. I guess that's all. No, what's this?"
The captain drew out a small, thin, black leather wallet. As he opened it, a little silver badge dropped to the floor. He let it lie as he looked inside. The wallet was empty, and he tossed it and the silver badge on the bed also.
"That's all," he said, "and not much. His address is on the passport. That will be enough for my purpose, I guess."
Val hardly heard him. His glance had riveted in startled surprise on the badge the captain had picked up, and Nancy Fraser's had done the same thing. Their eyes met for a moment, and it would have taken many words to interpret the meaning that flashed between them. For Carmody, the smiling book salesman, had been proved by that badge to be a Secret Service agent of the British government.